headlines, the United Kingdom's finally leaving the European Union, putting an end to its 48-year partnership with the bloc. Brazil reports more than 1,000 new coronavirus deaths for the third day in a row amid a resurgence of the pandemic in the South American country. And people around the world mark the start of 2021 like no other year under the shadow of COVID-19 as lockdowns and curfews curtail celebrations. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The United Kingdom has officially left the European Union after a long battle with the bloc to secure a trade deal. Britain cut all ties with the EU from 2,300 GMT on Thursday when it left the European Single Market and Customs Union. London managed to forge a trade agreement with Brussels last week to avoid a no-deal exit. Prime Minister Boris Johnson described the departure as a new beginning for the UK while keeping the EU as the country's biggest ally. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, however, told Europe to, quote, keep the lights on because Scotland would be back soon. Brexit has dominated British politics since the country's close vote to leave the bloc in June 2016. Political commentator Jonathan Fryer says the UK's official exit from the European Union is a big loss for Britain, and the situation is far from being settled.
Yes, that's correct. The situation is still far from settled. Of course, a lot of people in Britain are relieved that the Brexit debate is over. It's taken us over 4 years to get to this stage, and now we have formally left the European Union, the single market, etc. But it's going to take years to work out details of various trade negotiations, because although we have left with a deal, as Mr. Johnson is so proud to say, it's only the outlines of a deal, really, and there will be very intense negotiations, particularly on an area like financial services, which covers about 80% of the British economy and has still not been settled at all. For the last 40 years or so, British citizens have been able to travel, work, study and live in other European Union member states without any extra visas or paperwork to do, whereas now we've lost that. All our freedom of movement is gone. All we can do is visit as tourists for a limited period of time, up to 90 days in any 180-day period.
The coronavirus pandemic is raging on across Europe, with several countries still reporting a large number of infections and deaths. Italy reported 555 more coronavirus deaths on Thursday, rising its total tally to over 74,000. The southern number of infections also rose by nearly 23,500, bringing the total number of confirmed cases to 2.1 million. In the UK, officials registered 964 more deaths and nearly 56,000 new infections. In Germany, the government has warned that the health crisis will extend into the new year.
Liebe Mitbürgerinnen, liebe Mitbürger.
These days and these weeks, there is nothing to gloss over, are difficult times for our country, and that is going to last for a good while yet. It will be up to all of us for quite some time how we get through this pandemic. Winter is and remains difficult.
Angela Merkel's comments come as Germany has seen an upward trend in the number of infections over the past weeks. The country has reported more than 32,500 new cases, raising its total tally to over 1.7 million. The death toll there has also risen by nearly 1,000 to top 33,000. Brazil has recorded over 1,000 new fatalities from COVID-19, taking its overall death toll to more than 194,000. The The South American country has also registered over 56,000 daily cases, bringing its total infections since the beginning of the pandemic to more than 7.6 million. However, a Brazilian lab has reported two cases of the new highly contagious coronavirus variant and urged a reinforcement of quarantine measures for travelers coming from Europe. Americans' assessment of the national economy, buying climate, and their personal finances has all worsened amid the surge of the COVID-19 in the country. Bloomberg Consumer Comfort Index tells us that it has fallen to its lowest since late August. The sentiment index for the national economy also tumbled to its lowest since early July, following three consecutive weeks of decline. The measure of attitudes about personal finances plummeted to a four-month low. The pandemic has not only taken a heavy toll on the U.S. economy, but also on the American people. The U.S. remains the world's worst-hit country, with over 345,000 deaths out of nearly 20 million cases so far. Now, at least 140 Republican members of the U.S. House of Representatives reportedly plan to support President Donald Trump's effort to overturn election results. U.S. media quoted two House Republicans as saying that the 140 lawmakers will object to certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College victory when Congress convenes next week. On Wednesday, Republican Josh Hawley of Missouri became the first senator to publicly confirm plans to object to the November 3rd election results. That will force lawmakers in both the House and the Senate to vote on whether to accept the results, likely only delaying the affirmation of Biden's victory. Trump has refused to concede to Biden, citing election fraud. He has urged his supporters to descend upon Washington on January 6th to pursue, to pressure, that is, lawmakers not to certify Biden's win. Now, millions across the world are marking the beginning of 2021 with celebrations at the stroke of midnight.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1!
Mass crowds gathered along the Jumeirah beach as the fireworks lit up the United Arab Emirates Burj Khalifa in Dubai. Lights danced across the Red Square in the Russian capital, Moscow, this year empty of spectators due to the COVID-19 restrictions. Firework displays took place at the iconic Sky Tower in New Zealand's largest city of Auckland. Similar events were held in Australia's major cities, including Sydney. People mostly watched the displays from home as they bid farewell to a tumultuous year plagued by the coronavirus pandemic. Now, Iran has issued a stern warning to the United Nations Security Council about the United States' recent provocative moves in the Persian Gulf. In a letter to the Council, Iran's permanent mission to the UN said the U.S. has ramped up its military presence and activities in the region in recent weeks. It raised the alarm over what it called U.S. warmongering tendencies, adding that Washington must bear the full responsibility of these consequences. The letter also echoed Iran Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif's remarks, who said Iran does not seek war but will openly and directly defend its people, security, and vital interests. Tensions in the region escalated after U.S. President Donald Trump accused Iran of playing a role in the attacks on the U.S. embassy in Iraq late last month, threatening retaliation. January the 3rd marks the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Muna Kendall, has talked to a number of Palestinian experts on General Soleimani's death anniversary.
We consider Qasem Soleimani a martyr of Al-Quds because Iran has always supported the Palestinian resistance. We must concentrate on the spirit of resistance. Today, we resist illegal settlements as Israel continues to build here and there. We must stress on the real call of resistance. Our right is our weapon, and we will resist. We are the real owners of the land and the cause, no matter how long the night It will end with a new dawn, and the dawn is coming.
Qasem Soleimani is a well-known leader, and his contributions are known in supporting Palestinians to get their freedom and to face the American-Israeli aggression. The U.S. opposed that by assassinating martyr Qasem Soleimani, Palestinians and their cause would dim. It was a cowardly operation, and Tehran's response was bold and immediate. I believe that the loss of Qasem Soleimani is a loss of a real national leader who worked hard to fight the American-Israeli oppression. He was always a strong defendant of Al-Quds. He supported Palestinians to end the Israeli occupation and its ongoing violence that is supported by the American administration. His memory remains as an inspiration for resistance fighters, and our people will always remain loyal to the sacrifices of this great leader.
Martyr Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in a cowardly operation. His assassination, done by the US and Israel, is a crime, and those behind the attack must be held accountable. Today, we remember Martyr Soleimani with respect and pride. This martyr will always be remembered by all the people who are eager for freedom.
Iran's anti-terrorism icon was assassinated by the United States military in the Iraqi capital Baghdad on January the 3rd. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was the highest-ranking commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Soleimani played a key role in strengthening resistance movements across the region. The commander took part in different battlefields to lead resistance fighters. A quiet, charismatic man, a strategic genius, and a tactical operator who spent most of his life in combat. Soleimani first set foot on a battlefield in the 1980s when the newly founded Islamic Republic of Iran came under attack by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Soleimani was at the time a young man in his 20s fighting tirelessly to defend Iranian soil against the aggressor. After 8 years of war, Soleimani emerged battle-tested and battle-hardened. He became a national hero and a beloved commander in the IRGC. Soleimani and the forces under his command soon became one of the instrumental players in combating terrorism in Iran's southeastern areas and in Afghanistan. But the most important chapter of his military career started when he became the chief commander of the IRGC's Quds Force in 1998. General Soleimani strongly supported the Palestinian cause. He spared no effort to strengthen the Hezbollah resistance movement in Lebanon. During the 33-day war between Israel and Lebanese resistance fighters in 2006, General Soleimani went to Lebanon to oversee the battle against the Israeli regime. The fight against the Daesh terrorist group probably marked the climax of his anti-terror endeavors. During the tough campaign against Daesh, he was often seen in battlefields in Iraq and Syria. General Soleimani was the brain behind key operations that paralyzed the monster terror group and rolled back its advances. Soleimani has long been a household name in Iran and many regional countries. His presence in the battle against terrorism gave people a sense of security. It is no doubt tough for them to deal with his loss. People in Iraq and Iran are still mourning the loss of their anti-terror icon. Soleimani's funeral processions have become a symbol of unity. Following the US assassination, regional resistance groups pledged to remain steadfast on his path. The general is no longer among us, but his martyrdom seems to have given fresh blood to the resistance front.
Moving on, a bomb explosion has reportedly targeted a convoy belonging to the U.S.-led military coalition in the southeastern Iraqi city of Al-Shamawa in the Mutana province. Local media stated that the bomb was planted on the side of the road and exploded as the coalition's logistic convoy passed. So far, no casualties have been reported. On Sunday, a similar blast targeted U.S.-led coalition trucks carrying logistics supplies south of the Iraqi capital. American forces and their supply convoys have repeatedly come under attack in Iraq over the past months amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments there. Iraqi people and political figures have time and again called for the expulsion of all U.S. troops from their country. The year 2020 was filled with exceptionally significant incidents, from massive protests to war and destruction. Many people believe the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic could put a stop to these events, but it didn't. Let's take a look at some of the most noticeable incidents of the past 12 months.
Donald Trump became the third U.S. president who faced an impeachment trial. Trump was accused of abuse of power for seeking help from the Ukrainian government in order to help himself get re-elected in the November presidential election. He was alleged to have held back millions of dollars of military aid to Ukraine and dangled a proposed White House meeting with the Ukrainian president, both as bargaining chips. In exchange, reports said the U.S. president wanted Ukraine to publicly announce an investigation into Joe Biden in order to challenge him in the election. Trump denied all accusations. The impeachment trial concluded with Trump's acquittal on February the 5th. U.S. President Donald Trump unveiled his Middle East plan in a White House press conference alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. What Trump presented gave Israel what it had sought over decades of corruption, while offering the Palestinians the possibility of a state with limited sovereignty. The plan discarded the long-time goal of granting the Palestinians a full-fledged state. While Trump called it a win-win for both sides, Palestinian leaders immediately rejected it. The global stock market crash, also known as the coronavirus crash, was a major global shock that shook the world. It was the fastest fall in financial history and the most devastating one since the Wall Street crash of 1929. It also signaled the beginning of the COVID-19 recession. A black man was brutally killed after being arrested by a white police officer outside a shop in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Footage of George Floyd's arrest shows police officer Derek Chauvin kneeling on the victim's neck while he was pinned to the floor. Floyd said more than 20 times he could not breathe as he was restrained by the officer.
Please! Please, I can't breathe!
The killing of Floyd sparked yet another wave of nationwide anti-racism protests across the United States. To crack down on protesters, the government used different methods ranging from deploying the National Guard to threatening the use of armed forces against the people. The 59th quadrennial presidential election in the United States was held between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. The vote saw a record number of ballots cast early using the postal voting system due to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. As a result of the large number of mail-in ballots, some swing states saw delays in vote counting and reporting. This led to major news outlets delaying their projection of Biden as the winner until November the 7th, 4 days after the election. Trump rejected the result and called the election rigged. His campaign and allies continued to engage in numerous attempts to overturn the results by filing dozens of legal challenges in several states. Most of the legal suits were dropped or dismissed by various courts.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs.
Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
North Korea says the only way it will give up its nuclear weapons is if the U.S. abandons its hostile policy. In other words, takes reciprocal steps toward arms reduction. But so far, Washington has made no moves nor indicated any intention of moving toward that goal, says Hyun Lee Ryder in an article published under the heading, U.S. Must Commit to Arms Reduction if it wants North Korea to do so. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. For decades, U.S. policymakers have asked, how do we get North Korea to give up nuclear weapons, and have come up empty-handed. As the Biden administration prepares to take office, perhaps it's time to ask a different question. How do Americans get to peace with North Korea? Here's the dilemma facing Washington. On the one hand, the U.S. doesn't want to allow North Korea to have nuclear weapons because that may encourage other countries to do the same. The U.S. has tried to get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons through pressure and sanctions, but that approach has backfired, hardening Pyongyang's resolve to hone its nuclear and missile technology. North Korea says the only way it will give up its nuclear weapons is if the U.S. abandons its hostile policy, in other words, takes reciprocal steps toward arms reduction. But so far, Washington has made no moves, nor indicated any intention of moving toward that goal. In fact, the Trump administration continued to conduct joint war drills with South Korea and tightened enforcement of sanctions against North Korea, despite its commitment in Singapore to make peace with Pyongyang. Enter Joe Biden. How will his team resolve this dilemma? Repeating the same failed approach and expecting a different result would be, well, you know, how the saying goes. Biden's advisors are in consensus that the Trump administration's all-or-nothing approach, demanding upfront that North Korea give up all its weapons, has failed. Instead, they recommend an arms control approach, first freezing North Korea's plutonium and uranium nuclear operations, and then taking incremental steps toward the ultimate goal of complete denuclearization. This is the preferred approach of Secretary of State nominee Antony Blinken, who advocates an interim deal to cap North Korea's nuclear weapons to buy time to work out a long-term agreement. He says, we should get allies and China on board to pressure North Korea. Squeeze North Korea to get it to the negotiating table. We need to cut off its various avenues and access to resources, he says, and advocates telling countries with North Korean guest workers to send them home. If China won't cooperate, Blinken suggests that the U.S. threaten it with more forward-deployed missile defense and military exercises. Blinken's proposal is barely different from the failed approach of the past. It's still a policy of pressure and isolation to get to the ultimate goal of unilaterally disarming North Korea. The only difference being that the Biden administration is willing to take more time getting there. In this case, North Korea will likely continue to press forward on its nuclear weapons and missile capability. Unless the U.S. drastically shifts its position, renewed tension between the U.S. and North Korea is inevitable. Instead of focusing on how to get North Korea to give up its nukes, asking how to reach permanent peace in Korea may lead to a different and more fundamental set of answers. All parties, not just North Korea, have a responsibility to take steps toward mutual arms reduction. After all, the U.S. still has 28,000 troops in South Korea, and until recently, regularly conducted massive war exercises that included plans for preemptive strikes on North Korea. Past joint war drills have included flying B-2 bombers, which are designed to drop nuclear bombs and cost U.S. taxpayers approximately $130,000 an hour to fly. Although the U.S. and South Korea have scaled back their exercises since the Trump-Kim summit in 2018, the commander of U.S. Forces Korea, General Robert B. Abrams, has called for the resumption of the large-scale joint war drills. If the Biden administration moves ahead with the war drills next March, it would renew dangerous military tension on the Korean Peninsula and harm any chance for diplomatic engagement with North Korea in the near future. To reduce the threat of nuclear war with North Korea and preserve the option of resuming talks in the future, the Biden administration can do two things in its first 100 days. One, continue to the suspension of large-scale U.S.-South Korean joint war drills. And two, start a strategic review of its North Korea policy that begins with the question, how do we get to permanent peace on the Korean Peninsula? An essential part of establishing permanent peace is ending the Korean War, which has remained unresolved for 7 years, and replacing the armistice or temporary ceasefire with a permanent peace agreement. This is what the two Korean leaders agreed to do in their historic Panmunjom summit in 2018. And the idea has the support of 52 members of the U.S. Congress who co-sponsored House Resolution 152 calling for a formal end of the Korean War. 7 years of unresolved war has not only fueled a perpetual arms race among the parties to the conflict, it has also created an impenetrable border between the two Koreas that has kept millions of families apart. A peace agreement that commits all parties to a gradual process of laying down their arms would create peaceful conditions for the two Koreas to resume cooperation and reunite separated families. Many people in the U.S. think North Korea doesn't want peace, but looking back at its past statements reveals otherwise. For example, following the Korean War, which had ended in an armistice in 1953, North Korea was part of the Geneva Conference, convened by the four powers, including the United States, the former USSR, the United Kingdom, and France, to discuss the future of Korea. According to a declassified report by the U.S. delegation, then North Korean Foreign Minister Nam Second stated that this conference, that the principal task is achieving Korean unity by converting the armistice into lasting peaceful reunification of Korea on democratic principles. He blamed the United States of America for responsibilities in division of Korea, as well as for holding separate elections under police pressure. U.S. officers Dean Ross and Charles Bonestell had divided Korea along the 38th parallel in 1945 without consulting any Koreans, and the U.S. had pushed for a separate election in the South, even though most Koreans had desired a unified, independent Korea. Nevertheless, Nam continued, the 1953 armistice now opened the way to peaceful unification. He recommended the withdrawal of all foreign forces within 6 months and an agreement on all Korea elections to establish a government representing the whole country. The Geneva Conference unfortunately ended without an agreement on Korea, due in large part to U.S. opposition to Nam's proposal. Consequently, the demilitarized zone, DMZ, between the Koreas hardened into an international border. North Korea's basic position that the armistice should be replaced by a peace agreement that opens the way to peaceful unification has been consistent for the past 7 years. That's what the Supreme People's Assembly of North Korea proposed to the U.S. Senate back in 1974. That's what the North Koreans repeatedly brought up in their nuclear negotiations with the Bill Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. The Biden administration should look back at and acknowledge the agreements the U.S. has already signed with North Korea.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and on the eve of the new year of the Gregorian calendar, we present you an interesting saying regarding Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as related by his divinely designated vicegerent, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. The messenger of Allah called me and said, O Ali, verily there is a similarity between you and Jesus, the son of Mary, peace be upon him. The Christians love him so much that they put him in a position that was not for him. And the Jews hate him so much that they even slandered his mother. Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib added, two groups of men will be ruined because of me. He who goes to extremes in love of me for what I do not have, and he who hates me with a hatred that makes him slander me.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program Ulama Speech. In today's program, we will listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
امام عسکری علیه السلام از مهمترین کارهاش برای اینکه مردم آماده غیبت بشن شبکه وکالت هم.
From among the most important actions of Imam Hasan al-Askari for the people's preparation for the occultation was to strengthen the network of representatives, telling the people you should be connected to them with one who deeply knows the religion, has taqwa, that is piety, is adil, meaning he is just, be connected with them. So that in the time of the ghaiba, the occultation, if you aren't able to contact us directly, if you aren't able to connect with us, don't lose your religion due to not having a connection with the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. Today, at times, somebody asks, who is your marja taqlid? Response, oh sir, marjo taqlid, all these that are in Qum. What do you mean by all these that are in Qum? Who is your marjo taqlid? It must be specific. You should know. You refer to a specialist when you get a cold. Why not in the matters of religion? They, the maraja, are the specialists. A jurisprudent with deep knowledge of the religion, with taqwa, that is piety, and he is adil, meaning he is just. A person must refer to them in their personal issues. As per social issues, refer to that which is known as wilayatul faqih. Our imams did not just leave us alone. Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
Whistleblowers, mainly former employees at Aramco, say the mecca for oil engineers is not what it wants to be known for. For years, many foreigners would like to work at Aramco to enjoy its high salaries and big bonuses. They say bullying and mistreatment of expatriates, mismanagement and racism are the current realities on the ground. The company has laid off hundreds of foreign workers, restricted overtime pay and holiday leave. Insiders say they have to work more for less. As a result of the coronavirus pandemic, Saudi Aramco has had to cut corners. This has affected the safety of the employees. According to a current worker at the company's Jizan refinery project, who spoke to Financial Times on condition of anonymity, the way it's going, this refinery runs a real risk of becoming Saudi Arabia's Piper Alpha, referring to the 1988 disaster that killed 167 workers on a North Sea oil rig. There has been a multitude of sins. People have been pressured to sign off work without the proper systems checks. It's got inherent issues that have been covered up or patched over that pose a real safety risk.
With Aramco, which, as I said, one of the richest companies in the world, you know, this is a terrible. It shows that their priorities are misplaced. And, of course, also it indicates they're under a lot of pressure to meet deadlines. They're having, you know, serious reduction in the amount of money they have. And, of course, they're being pressured by the Crown Prince and other Saudi officials to, you know, to get rid of foreign workers and to nationalize their economy. But in the rush to do so, they are taking risks, and these people are not necessarily skilled, and of course they don't like criticism. So like many other people in countries, they think they know everything, but that is not the case, especially when you're dealing with a highly technical and dangerous you know, industry like the oil extraction industry.
Some say the mistreatment of the expatriates at Saudi Aramco is the result of the Saudi Crown Prince's Saudization of the kingdom's workforce. In 2019, youth unemployment was above 30%. It was in 2016 that Mohammed bin Salman told The Economist there are 10 million jobs that are being occupied by non-Saudi employees in the kingdom that I can resort to at any time of my choosing. This obvious change of attitude towards expats has undermined their safety at work.
In Aramco, which is, you know, the first or second richest company in the world, you think that they would be able to look after their workers. In the past, they have, but there's, I guess, a series of problems that Aramco is facing. One is the severe decline in the price of oil. Secondly, you have the Saudization program from the Crown Prince, who wants to hire more Saudis and get rid of like as much as 10% of the foreign workforce each year, which is a good goal, but they're trying to do it too quickly, and it's creating problems because the people aren't qualified to do the job, and they're in a rush to please their employers. And the facility at Jazan was supposed to have been finished in 2016, and it's not.
The Jazan refinery, Aramco's mega project that started in 2012, is a case in point. Whistleblowers say the project has been beset with problems, such as subsidence of foundations and cracks in the refinery structure, which can be highly dangerous for those working there. According to another worker at Saudi Aramco, "I truly never believed that coming to Saudi Arabia to work for the world's biggest oil and gas producer to help them construct a refinery the magnitude of Jazan could end so badly." Another employee says that working at Aramco is a matter of life and death, as the Saudi security forces cannot protect the company against the Yemenis, with whom Riyadh has been at war since 2015. A British engineer, who introduced himself as Michael Redding, not his real name, told the Financial Times that he was forced to leave Saudi Aramco to protect his health. Witness to a missile attack at Jazan, which is close to the Yemen border, he was diagnosed with early-stage post-traumatic stress disorder. "The doctor warned that if I went back to Jazan, I would get PTSD I would find it hard to recover from." He continued, "After the missile attack, you look with fresh eyes and realize we're on the verge of a war zone, but there's little provision in place for workers' safety. I ask, what provisions are you making for our safety? And they'd rub their hands together and say, God willing, it'll be fine." Meanwhile, the coronavirus pandemic has made the situation even worse at Aramco. According to whistleblowers, there are no screening of workers arriving at the site after trips, making it a major vector for infection. That level of indifference from the management has shocked many at Saudi Aramco. In the words of one of the employees, "You couldn't get a test unless you were at death's door." Meanwhile, engineers from Europe or North America are reportedly provided with better medical care and accommodation, while those hailing from Asian countries such as Bangladesh and Pakistan are almost neglected.
Unfortunately, I think it's a widespread problem within Saudi management, even in the other workers, that they tend to have a racist attitude and discriminate against blacks, you know, Bangladeshis, Filipinos, other workers, especially who are not sort of, you know, white from the United States and Canada and Britain. So yes, there is a big problem, and obviously they made a big error, which not only he's contagious, he's spreading it to other workers, and they should have moved quickly on it. So their negligence, quite frankly, has resulted in the death of this individual, but probably also in many other people being infected with COVID-19, which is, you know, a very bad policy and even, you know, criminally negligent. So yes, I think this is a terrible example, and you know, the Saudis and the Saudi medical officials and Aramco and other companies need to be much more vigilant and take urgent steps to prevent the spread of COVID and to protect the workers, quite frankly.
Despite all the inhumane conditions, those who work at Saudi Aramco daren't speak out. They say it might cost them their jobs. They also say it's a waste of time and energy to file a lawsuit against the company inside the kingdom, as the major shareholders are the Saudi royals, who regard themselves as being above the law.
Yes, it'd be almost impossible to win a legal battle because the system is compromised. Most of the shareholders are, of course, Saudi members of the Saudi royal family, and there also is this sort of arrogance that you know, the Saudis have, that they are dismissive of foreign workers and they know everything and they're great, even though they really haven't had the experience, they haven't got the proper culture to avoid problems and to take proactive measures to prevent them. And as a result, Western employees and other employees are very concerned, and this is going to have, you know, I think, long-term negative implications for you know, the Saudi royal family and for Arabia and for its oil industry.
Saudi Aramco is by far the best place expatriates can work inside the kingdom. If this is the situation there, what is it like in other places inside Saudi Arabia?
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
An analysis of COVID bailout data found that American companies at which 28 members of Congress or their spouses hold positions received at least $27 million in loans likely to be forgiven under the CARES Act. The listeners stay with us for an article in this regard written jointly by Justin Glaw and Jeremy Borden Writers. This article is published under the heading, Members of U.S. Congress Profited from Paycheck Protection Program. Here's the details of this article. As members of U.S. Congress pat themselves on the back for passing a new coronavirus relief package after a nine-month impasse, Americans can count on less money in the form of stimulus checks and unemployment insurance than they did in the spring, when Congress passed the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, that is CARES Act, and took advantage of it themselves. A new analysis of COVID bailout data found that companies at which 28 members of Congress or their spouses hold positions, received at least $27 million in loans, likely to be forgiven under the CARES Act. The revelation that so many members of U.S. Congress personally benefited from the Paycheck Protection Program, that is PPP, and the Economic Inquiry Disaster Loans, EIDL, authorized by the CARES Act, comes as U.S. Congress must consider how to address President Donald Trump's demand that all Americans be given $2,000 stimulus checks after their bill cut in half unemployment insurance and stimulus checks for Americans compared to an earlier House proposal. President Trump criticized the bill but fell short of saying he will veto it. Congress appears to have enough votes to override a veto. House Republicans recently blocked Democrats' attempts to increase stimulus check payments from $600 to $2,000. Reports found that 18 congressional Republicans and one Libertarian have received $21.7 million for 38 businesses with which they are associated. Nine Democrats received $6.1 million for 11 of their own businesses. An additional roughly $54 million went to nonprofits, think tanks and policy institutes, congressional caucuses, and higher education institutions tied to members of both parties. While the majority of Democrats and Republicans voted to pass COVID relief package, two Democrats and 57 Republicans voted against it. Among the Republicans who voted to not fund a second round of PPP, among other provisions, are 10 who received $15.3 million in PPP loans from the CARES Act. The opportunities for corruption and a scandal are particularly ripe when the business interests of members of Congress and other government officials go to the trough for public funds from programs they helped design, said Craig Holman of Public Citizen, a nonpartisan government watchdog. Like the larger business that reaped the greatest rewards from the PPP program, government officials themselves have inside knowledge of how the application process works and who to contact for the public assistance. Even if no deliberate favoritism is involved, the optics of potential self-dealing alone undermines public confidence in these programs. Representative Brett Guthrie was one of the members of the Congress who voted nay on the recent bill. He also benefited from PPP funding when his family's business received $4.3 million in loans that most likely will not have to be repaid. Along with many other Republicans, Guthrie had decried the stimulus spending aimed at ordinary workers and individuals who do not earn six-digit salaries. In July, Guthrie, PPP recipient, Representative Ralph Norman, and 33 other GOP representatives wrote to President Trump and implored him to stop extended unemployment benefits from reaching jobless Americans in the spring and summer. Extending the additional $600 in weekly unemployment checks would only slow economic recovery, the lawmakers wrote. It is not illegal or against House and Senate ethics rules for members to hold positions outside their duties in Congress, and many do, while simultaneously